Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the RBC podcast. My name's Mark Cleesby and today I'm talking with Dr. Julian Drew, a research fellow in the Department of Veterinary Epidemiology here at the RBC, who has spent a lot of time both at the University of Cambridge and here at the RBC studying infectious diseases of wildlife, and in particular investigating the role that wildlife species play in the spread of TB in cattle, thus continuing the theme of the last episode of the RBC podcast. Okay, Julian, thanks very much for joining us today. What would you say was the overall significance of wildlife reservoirs for infectious diseases in animals?
Okay, well, I think there are three important reasons why diseases in wildlife are important. Often these infectious diseases are transmissible to people, so these are called zoonoses, so they can threaten human health. They may also pass to domestic animals, both livestock and pets. But also, you know, and quite importantly, of course, they can affect the wildlife species themselves. And in cases where species are endangered, it can be of conservation importance.
Sure.
And globally, this has actually had an effect where some species have gone extinct, so it can affect biodiversity.
Okay, so what are examples where, for example, endangered species have been, shall we say, further endangered in this sort of scenario?
Okay, well, one that springs to mind would be the rabies virus, and this has affected both wild dogs and domestic dogs in parts of the Serengeti in Africa.
Right.
The disease seems to be maintained in the domestic and the feral dog populations, which greatly outnumber the wild dogs, and then the wild dogs, which are an endangered species themselves, get the disease spilling over into them. And this is quite interesting because to control the disease, you can actually target the domestic and the feral dogs by vaccinating them, and this is a program that's been quite successfully used. So then you get the benefit of reduced rabies, not only in the domestic animals, but knock-on effect is you don't actually have to trap or anything like that the wildlife to protect it, and the knock-on effect of that is both reduced incidence of rabies in wildlife and domestic animals, and then of course the reduced risk to the people as well.
Okay, and of course, obviously, it's desirable not to interfere too much with an endangered species, I guess, and reduce
That's
the stress
right.
on that population. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, usually when we're dealing with wildlife, one of the biggest problems is actually, you know, working out how to collect the data or the samples, whatever we need, in the sort of least stressful way and the least difficult way. It's quite hard actually getting data and samples from wildlife as opposed to working with cattle or horses or something like that.
Yes, now following on from the previous podcast, obviously we spent some time discussing tuberculosis. So what are the wildlife reservoir species then for TB around the world?
Okay, well, I just thought it was a good point just to define what a reservoir host was here. And what we mean when we say a reservoir in terms of wildlife is a species which can maintain an infectious disease just by passing it between members of that species.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't need an external source of reinfection from other animals to keep it going. And in the UK, the species which is considered the main reservoir in the wildlife would be the badger. And most people have heard about TB in cattle and badgers in this country. And certainly the prevalence of TB in badgers is very high in parts of southwest England and Wales, which is where the high density of badgers are. So in the UK, it's the badger. In southern Africa, the buffalo is considered a reservoir species there.
Mm-hmm.
It has a slightly different role in the epidemiology of the disease because infected buffalo can pass the infection on to predators like lions who predate on them.
Right.
And often lions will go after the sort of weaker individuals. And since TB causes sort of chronic emaciation and lethargy, they might be the more likely to get infected prey. And also scavengers that come out carcasses like baboons and things like that can be infected that way. It's actually quite an interesting scenario that in places such as Kruger National Park in South Africa, where the TB has spread principally in the buffalo, but many other species as well, it's now starting to pose a bit of a risk to domestic cattle that are grazing around the outside of the park. And it's thought that actually the infection in the buffalo originated in the cattle around 50 or so years ago, so it's sort of completing a full cycle now, if you like. And that's one of the key things about Mycobacterium bovis, the causal agent of bovine TB, is that it seems to be very happy at crossing the species boundary and affecting many different species of mammal, even though it seems to be commonly at home in cattle, it can infect many other species.
Right, so obviously it's quite a complex situation, certainly in Africa, but I mean, we've mentioned the badger here, but it does affect other species in the UK as well, doesn't it?
Yes, indeed. Other species can be infected. Many species of deer could carry it, and in fact do carry it, although whether they are important in infecting other species is less clear. There's been less work done on that. And certainly the level of TB in these wildlife species is lower than in the badger. So other species such as foxes and small mammals can become infected with either M. bovis, Mycobacterium bovis, or other similar species of TB. But whether they play a big role in affecting other species is unknown.
Okay, so how does one then set out to do research into the spread of tuberculosis between these various species? How do you work these sorts of things out?
Okay, well, it is a challenge to do this, but there's a lot of bit work that has been done and continues to be done on TB and wildlife species around the world. I think, yeah, one of the important things to do is, firstly, not only are we looking at populations of animals, but we're looking at a whole sort of ecosystem. We're looking at how animals interact both within their species and between species, and what the effect the environment has on the epidemiology of the disease. So whether the disease can be transmitted indirectly through surviving in the environment, for example, in a badger set or on the ground, for example, and reinfect other animals. Now, interactions between animals was one focus of research. So, for example, in the USA, contacts between wild deer and bison and cattle would be a focus of study in order to determine how frequently these occur, when they occur, what sort of individuals are involved. Mm-hmm. And then the idea would be to sort of target management practices to reduce the contact rate. So simple things like not putting out supplementary feed for the deer in winter, which encourages them all to come down and mix together, which can spread disease quite easily,
right.
Would be the result of that sort of research. And then in the UK, when we're looking at other species like the badger, we've been doing similar research looking at how badgers interact with each other and where they roam. And at the moment, we're starting a study looking at how they interact with cattle so we can get a handle on how disease can potentially transmit between all these different animals.
Okay, so observing contacts between animals obviously indicates the likelihood of transfer of the disease, but do you also undertake capture-release type studies then to establish the rates of infection in different species?
Yeah, indeed we do. So in the badger situation, there's been an ongoing study that started in the 1970s where badgers have been cage-trapped in parts of Gloucestershire. They are enticed into the traps by using peanuts, which they're quite fond of.
Okay.
And this will be done sort of three or four times throughout the year. And the badgers will then be given a very short anaesthetic. And whilst they're under anaesthesia, we would collect different samples to test them for disease, principally TB, but also the presence of other infections would become apparent at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing this over a long period of time, you will retrap the same individuals and you'll get an idea of the nature of disease over time, which is actually a really important, quite a powerful tool then to understand how the disease is changing with time and with numbers of badgers and with different weather factors and things like this. And so a longitudinal study is really helpful in wildlife disease to pick up clues as to both how the disease may be transmitted, but also the trends over time give you information on the bigger picture.
So you've spent quite a bit of time working in Africa with the reservoir populations over there, and one of these populations is meerkats, which I guess may be familiar to many of our listeners in their cuddlier incarnations. But what role do they play in maintaining bovine TB?
Well, meerkats are, as you say, very social species living in groups. The short answer to your question, do they maintain the disease, is unclear. So we can get some clues from the pathology of this disease in them, in the meerkats, by doing post-mortem examinations. And what we find is that it's not just a disease of the lungs, as most people think TB is.
Mm-hmm.
In meerkats, it's very disseminated. You've got lesions in many of the main organs, your liver, your spleen, your lymph nodes, and your lungs.
Right.
So this suggests, firstly, that there are plenty of possible routes for meerkats to infect others. But whether there is enough transmission just between meerkats to maintain the disease, as I say, is unclear at the moment. It's possible that they are getting reinfected from other species which live in the same area which they do, which, for example, would be ground squirrels who share burrows with meerkats. But there's a lot of research still to be done on all these other species that interact with meerkats in order to determine this sort of conclusively. And my research focused principally on the interactions between meerkats and how that affected the transmission of TB within the meerkat population.
Okay, so what sort of findings came out of that study?
Well, we found that quite a high percentage of meerkats actually seem to be infected with TB within the study population. Around a third of the meerkats actually showed evidence of being infected. Although a third were carrying the infection, most look quite healthy, and most of those are not infectious to others. It's a typical sign of TB that only a small minority of those that are infected are actually infectious to others. And if we look at the interactions between meerkats that seem to be involved in transmitting this disease, we can see correlations between the amount of grooming and the amount of aggression that individuals are involved in, and how this affects the spread of TB between them. We actually don't need to know just about the types of interaction, but we actually need to look at the direction of interaction. So in other words, who's grooming who, the risk from grooming is different from the risk of being groomed. We can see that meerkats that undertake a lot of grooming are at high risk of getting TB, and meerkats that receive a lot of aggression are also seen to be at high risk. But those that either dish out a lot of aggression or receive a lot of grooming are not at high risk. And so that's a quite nice explanation of why individuals like the dominant male and the dominant female, who are involved in a lot of interaction but principally dish out the aggression and receive the grooming, don't seem to be at high risk of getting the disease, and explains why they can live for many years longer than many of the others in the group.
Right, that was what I was going to follow up with. So obviously it's very much related to the dominance relationships within a group, but presumably also the stability of the group.
Indeed, so meerkats live in fairly stable social groups. And one of the questions I had was, well, how, once you get an infection within the group, you know, there's only a limited number of susceptible meerkats, how does it get between these different groups? And one of the answers is, well, it seems to be related to these roving male meerkats. These are young males that have temporary forays across the neighbouring groups looking for mating opportunities and then come back. So you've got this slight instability in group membership, and TB can then transmit between groups that way. And if we sort of look back in the UK at the badger situation, it's been quite widely reported about the perturbation effect of badger groups. And this is where if we try culling badgers and we create areas where we remove badgers from, then badgers in the neighbouring areas will sort of come into that void area, if you like, and you'll get increased mixing of individuals from different groups. And this seems to be a good method of transmitting the infection between groups.
Right, so obviously the implication then is that rates of infection vary geographically between different groups of animals, whichever species they are. It's some disturbance of some sort or just normal migration that can trigger off new infections. So how does the situation compare then with badgers in the UK?
Well, we do see increased incidence of TB in badger groups following fluctuations in group size. This can be naturally occurring. If badger groups get particularly large, then you may get individuals leaving perhaps. Or during the mating or the dispersal season, you might see an increased rate of TB following that. And it seems to fit with this idea that the nice, stable social groups sort of seem to keep the infection in certain places, and sort of we're trying to maintain this status quo.
In terms of the badger groups, the infections are fairly well confined to the sort of southwest of England and Wales, though, are they not?
The TB infections are certainly higher in prevalence in those areas.
Right.
If you think about how you find out where the infection is in badgers, you've either got to go out and trap and sample badgers all the whole of Britain, or you've got to rely on other methods of getting information about the infection. And one method you could use would be to collect badgers that have been run over on the road and look at the prevalence of infection that way. And this does give some indication of the spread of, or the location rather, of the disease in other parts of the country. But it is a bit of a biased sample, because it may be that the badgers that are more likely to be run over are the ones that are infected,
sure,
for example. Or it may be they've been lying by the road for a little bit too long, so you get a false negative result on your TB culture. But yes, the highest level of TB in badgers does seem to be in the southwest of England.
And you're involved in studying the dynamics of the badger groups at the moment?
Well, I'm involved in a study where we're looking at the interactions between the badgers within this study population, both within groups and between groups. We're using proximity loggers, which are radio collars which we fit to the badgers, and these record the interactions between them and other collared individuals. And this is important because it can give us information not only on how many other individuals a certain badger will interact with, but also how frequently and when. And we can identify certain individuals that are very highly interactive. And you do find that within any population of animals, most individuals have a small or a medium number of contacts with others, and a very small number have a very high number of contacts. And it has been thought that if we can identify these individuals or the characteristics of these individuals, then perhaps we can use these to target these certain individuals for intervention, so for example for vaccination, and therefore increase our chance of success.
Okay, so that would be in terms of reducing the pool of infection within the group of badgers anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. If we can reduce the amount of infection present in the badger population, then we reduce the chance of any disease transmitting across to cattle as well. So we can control the disease to an extent in the cattle by focusing on the badgers, but we also obviously have to have a cattle component there too.
Okay, so in terms of the control mechanisms within the badger population, what are the relative merits then of culling versus vaccination or maybe other strategies that are basically provoked by your sort of work?
Okay, well, indeed, culling or vaccination seem to be the two main possibilities that people talk about. There are others as well. If we look at the culling option, it does seem to be the case, certainly in the UK, that you would need to cull over a very large area rather. So here we'd be going out and effectively trapping and shooting badgers. That's what we mean by culling. And to avoid the perturbation effect on the periphery and to have a big enough effect at reducing the incidence of TB, we are going to have to do that over an extremely large area. Now, that's not only logistically very difficult and expensive to do, but it's also been non-viable economically. So a recent study showed that it costs around £120,000 to cull enough badgers to prevent one cattle herd breakdown with TB. And a breakdown of TB in cattle costs around £27,000. So in other words, we've got a net loss of around £100,000 per cattle herd that we've saved from TB by going down the badger culling route. And that's just the economics. We've also got to think about public opinion, which is very much against culling badgers, and the fact that badgers are a native species and they are protected. Critically as well, we would need to keep culling going on for a very long time. So, you know, we would need a lot of resources and a lot of input for a prolonged period of time, which is actually going to be very difficult to do.
Yeah, so it would be rather unfortunate after the badger population has recovered to a reasonable level now if we had to then go and reverse that.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So what about the vaccination side of things then?
Yeah, so the vaccination, well, I think it would seem the easiest thing to do would be to go out and vaccinate all the cattle. If our main aim is to try and prevent cattle TB, then we know where the cattle are, we can catch them and vaccinate them. At the moment, it's difficult to do that because the legislation prevents us from vaccinating cattle because they would then test positive for TB. There's no test to differentiate vaccinated from naturally infected animals at the moment. So whilst work is being done and advances are being made in this differentiation test, in the meantime, we were looking at vaccinating badgers. And a study has recently begun using six areas of the country go out and trap and inject badgers with a BCG vaccine. This is very similar to the human TB vaccine. And the idea here is to reduce the amount of TB within the badger populations in those areas below a threshold amount. So you don't actually need to target or catch all the badgers and vaccinate them in order to have an effective reduction in TB.
Right, so it's got to get to the magic level in order to provide the herd immunity.
Yeah, so if you can get it below the level at which every infected animal infects fewer than one other, then the disease should naturally sort of die out. And that's the aim there. But in the long term, I think an oral vaccination may be more sort of successful.
Yeah, so I was going to say, I mean, obviously capture and injection is going to be incredibly hard work. So presumably sort of dropping of baits or some other strategy like that would be more ideal.
Yeah, oral vaccination has been quite effective in controlling rabies, for example, in foxes in parts of Europe over the last 25 years. And this was a vaccine put in an edible bait, which was dropped from helicopters in this case, and foxes came along and ate it and got the immunity that way. You can even put a little marker in the bait so that you can tell if you find a fox that's dead afterwards whether it hadn't received the vaccine or not. Now, in the case of badgers, I don't think we'd be going around with helicopters dropping baits. I think they would need to be a bit more strategically placed to ensure that the badgers got them. rather than other animals. But yes, I think a vaccine where you can put it in a bait, put it out, and they go and sort of dose themselves is going to be a lot more straightforward and a lot less stressful for the badgers, of course, as well.
Sure. So what sort of further research is necessary then to develop these sorts of potential solutions and cut down the bovine TB infection rate?
Well, vaccine development is only one part of the problem. We obviously need to know how best to use our vaccine. Mm. And I mentioned earlier about sort of targeted vaccination of certain individuals. And this is research that needs to be done to identify the types of individual and the characteristics of these individuals so we can sort of get more bang for our buck, if you like, with targeting our vaccination. It has been estimated that you can improve your immunity on your population level by 3 times if you focus half of your resources on the most infectious 20% of the population. So what we're saying there is it is worth putting money into trying to identify these sort of super spreaders or these key individuals in order to vaccinate them as a priority. And this would be done through research into contact patterns between individuals. Your research is needed to characterise the attributes of these super spreaders, and this may identify certain individuals or even certain times of the year when it's best to vaccinate. Maybe it's at the time when badgers are most likely to disperse, for example, and we've got an increased chance of catching those individuals. So this is the sort of research that needs to be done. So I mentioned earlier about how some emerging technology is being used in the study of wildlife. For example, the proximity collars that are put on animals to record who they interact with. And we're seeing more advances with, for example, GPS devices getting smaller and smaller, so we can increasingly put those on wildlife too. And in fact, a recent study of Tasmanian devils in the wild in Australia has shown that by using the proximity logging devices, all the individuals within one study population interacted within a network. So they were all contacted either directly or indirectly with each other. And this is important from the spread of infectious diseases point of view, because it means that an infectious disease can spread quite rapidly and affect the whole population. And this, in terms of the Tasmanian devil, is crucial because they're affected by a disease that called devil facial tumour disease, which is an infectious cancer, which is actually having a big impact on the population levels. So we're looking at using similar technology in the badgers and other wildlife in the UK to see who interacts with who and the impact that will have on the spread of infectious diseases such as TB.
Okay. Julian Drew, thank you very much. And thanks very much to all our listeners out there. I hope very much you've enjoyed this podcast and you'll join us again next time. In the meantime, if you have any comments or suggestions with regard to the podcast, please feel free to email us at podcast@rvc.ac.uk. Thanks again.